Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a member of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our connection to our own humanity. This is episode 95. It's another joint episode with Tudor Times on Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, and of course, he's the possible soulmate to Queen Elizabeth. First, before we get into that, a bit of admin. So I still have some copies of the Tudor Planner left. That's the gorgeous monthly and weekly diary filled with Tudor history, listening lists, wrapped up in a gorgeous cover. People are calling it exquisite, which makes me so proud. Depending on when you listen to this, you likely won't get it in time for Christmas, but it could make a lovely 12th night present, or you can simply get it as the gift that you would have liked for Santa to have brought you. And I'm now discounting them by $10 since they won't arrive in time for Christmas. If you enter the code GIFTFORME, all one word, GIFTFORME, at checkout, you'll save $10. And by mid-January, they're all going to be gone until next year, so make sure you get yours soon. Next, I want to thank the lovely patrons of this show who helped to keep it independent. Thank you to Kathy, Cynthia, Jurgen, Olivia, Al, Ashley, Kendra, Anne Boleyn. I love that. Thank you, Jessica, Anne Boleyn. Elizabeth, another Cynthia, and Judith. Also, Selene. And if I butchered that, I'm so sorry. You'll have to email me and tell me the right way. And thank you. Laura, Candace, Kaylee, Ian, Barbara, Shar, Kiva, Amy, Allison, Joanne, Kathy, Christine, Annetta, Andrea, Catherine, Candace, Rebecca from Tudor's Dynasty, and Shandor. You're all awesome. As I'm reading your names right now, if you could see me, I'm actually reaching out my arms, giving you all a big hug because I'm so grateful to you. So thank you so much. I really am. Literally, I'm reaching out my arms, giving you a hug. So thank you. To learn more about how you can become someone on my super awesome list and get a hug from me every time I do a podcast, you can go to patreon.com/englandcast. Again, patreon.com/englandcast. Or if you go to englandcast.com, there's a donate and support area too, whichever is easiest. So now let me introduce you to Melita. Melita Thomas is the co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history from the period of 1485 to 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. She's also the author of a recent book called The King's Pearl about Mary I, so you should check that out. Melita has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson. She also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine. What can you tell us? There's so many different myths and stories we hear about him. What can you tell us about his life? He kind of grew up with Elizabeth. Is that?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. He was probably one of the young boys around Elizabeth's half brother Edward. Well, Prince Edward, as he was then. It was a custom for royalty to have other friends and family around them, so they didn't actually grow up by themselves. And because Edward and Elizabeth spent a fair amount of time housed in the same royal nursery palaces, she would have met Robert, you know, as part of the household. I think there's a record where one of them refers to having known the other since they were 8 years old. And then later, when during her sister's reign, they clearly kept in touch. Robert was in prison for a while at the same time as Elizabeth. They were both in the Tower of London following Wyatt's, her following Wyatt's rebellion and him following the failed coup of 1553. There's no evidence that they met then, but it seems to have formed a bit of a sort of bond of experience between them. And then during the period that she was hoping, no doubt, to become her sister's heir, they seem to have been in touch, although there's no details other than that he sold a piece of land for her benefit at some point that she was grateful for later. He was almost the first act when she became queen was to appoint him as her master of the horse, which suggests, quite a close friendship and certainly an appreciation of his skills in the duties of a master of the horse, which he undertook extremely well.
And so tell me about his life aside from Elizabeth, because he got married and presumably he did other things.
He did, yeah, although he did spend a huge amount of time with Elizabeth. He was definitely her closest friend for all of her life. I mean, they had quarrels and fallings out, and particularly over his second marriage, but you can see in the letters to each other that there was a real bond of affection between them, and he did spend a great deal of time at the court with her. So his first marriage took place before Elizabeth became queen, in the reign of Edward VI, when he married a young woman named Amy Robsart. She was the daughter of a well-to-do Norfolk gentleman, but she wasn't of any particularly high rank, and they were about the same age, and it's likely that it was a love match or a lust match, because if you look at the spouses that his father chose for Robert's siblings, they were of much, much higher rank. So Amy was a bit of an outlier, but she was, comfortably off. There's no real information about their early relationship. She visited him in the Tower. He was allowed to have visitors when he was in the Tower in Mary's reign, but they never had any children. Now, whether that was her or him isn't clear, because he did have a couple of children, although considering that he was married at least twice and possibly a third time, two children seems quite low. So perhaps he was
the issue was on his side just a bit.
Perhaps the issue was on his side. Yes.
Yes. Once Elizabeth became queen and he was master of the horse, what did he do kind of professionally leading up to becoming master of the horse? And obviously when he was in the Tower, he was in the Tower, but before then, like, what did he do?
Well, I mean, people didn't do anything in our sense. I mean, he had his father, his wife had money, and his father had settled an estate on him in Norfolk in the 15, about the time he got married. So like all gentlemen, he lived off his rents. Again, like most gentlemen, he practiced his military skills. He was he led a troop of soldiers under King Philip during the French Wars in 1557. He was present at the Battle of St. Quentin, which was a big Anglo-Spanish victory, and apparently acquitted himself very well there. Philip was so impressed with him that he actually sent him home with the news to Queen Mary. So he was rehabilitating himself in Mary's reign by being a supporter of King Philip.
There's the obvious question about his relationship with Elizabeth, and I'm sure there was more to him than that, so I want to talk more about him.
Yeah.
Besides that, but you can't talk about him without talking about that. So
I think what he did do once he didn't immediately become a privy councillor. So he was taken up with being master of a horse, which was actually quite a big job, because of course everything depended on horse transport, and the master of the horse was responsible for progresses and processions, for finding the queen's horses. She was a great hunter, like all her family, looking after ensuring that she had enough horses, that there were enough horses for her ladies in waiting, that baggage was transported, from place to place. So it was quite a wide ranging role. He had to buy horses, and that's not something that you can really delegate. You're either a good judge of horses or you're not. You can't really get anybody else to do it in quite so well as an experienced person can do it themselves. Once he became a privy councillor in 1565, he was actually one of the most active councillors. He attended more meetings than anybody other than Cecil. He took his duties very seriously as a councillor, and he was busy amassing a, you know, land as well. So he would have spent plenty of time on managing his estate. And then in the 1580s, he became Lieutenant Governor of the Netherlands. He was representing Elizabeth, leading the English troops who were supporting the Protestant United Provinces in their bid to at least obtain religious freedom from Philip of Spain. There were different views on what they should be doing. Robert, like many of the more Puritan members of Elizabeth's ministry, wanted to support the Netherlands in throwing off Spain altogether, whereas Elizabeth wanted Philip to give tolerance of the Protestant religion. She wasn't really that interested in overthrowing fellow monarchs because of the very poor example that that would set. He wasn't terribly effective as lieutenant governor. He couldn't get on with the Dutch terribly well, and he took a higher position from them than Elizabeth had wanted him to take, and there was a huge row over that. So he was a pretty active chap in government and politics.
So then were there always rumors about the two of them and their relationship, or at what point did that start?
Within a few months of her becoming queen, although he was still married at that time, his wife, they were only in their late 20s, from within a few weeks of her accession, he was seen to be beside her all of the time. And there were rumours that they were having an affair, which would have been bad enough if he'd been single, but the fact that he was a married man made it even worse. She swore that they never slept together, and I would have thought, given her determination to remain queen, that is probably true. But of course, one can't be absolutely certain. I mean, it would have been such a hostage to fortune if she had slept with him. I mean, Elizabeth wasn't the most trusting person in the world. How could she ever have trusted him? Doesn't seem very likely. But they danced together, they sang together, they hunted together. He spent time in her private apartments with her. And according to her, they were always chaperoned, but possibly not that closely. And it soon became rumoured that they were lovers and that his wife was looking very carefully at what she ate. So it wasn't long before people thought that Lady Dudley was going to come to a nasty, nasty end. There was a story that she was ill with a, quote, malady in the breast, but then another report said she was not ill, and that, you know, that the stories were just being put about so that if she died, people wouldn't be surprised. And then in September of 1560, she was found dead at the bottom of a flight of stairs with her neck broken.
And do you have any thoughts on this mystery? I don't think we're going to solve it here, but what are your thoughts on it?
I mean, a very interesting book on the topic, The Death and the Virgin by Chris Skidmore, was written 4 or 5 years ago now, I think, because the actual original inquest papers were found in the National Archives in 2008, which shed a bit more light on it. I would have thought it's unlikely that Robert murdered her on the basis that, you know, how likely was it that Elizabeth would marry a man who had murdered his wife? I mean, again, the likelihood of her being overthrown would be very high, although perhaps you can say we're reading that with hindsight, thinking about what happened to Mary, Queen of Scots, with the death of Darnley. Maybe, you know, that hadn't happened, so maybe it wasn't seen that it would have had quite the effect that had on Mary's life. He could have done it. He certainly, all the evidence suggests that he wanted an open and unbiased inquest. Although, you know, so he wrote to the local magistrates and the JP saying, please, you know, do everything you can to find out the truth. He didn't feign any kind of unnecessary grief, so he wasn't sort of, you know, pretending to be the sorrowing widower. Nobody thought he was particularly upset about it.
He went away from court for a while too, didn't he? He had to leave.
Elizabeth sent him away until the inquest was over. She wouldn't have anything to do with him until his name had been officially cleared. I mean, there is a theory that Cecil was behind it, that on the basis that a man with a wife dead in surprising circumstances was a less likely match than a man who, you know, might have found some way of having his marriage annulled. I mean, especially with no children. I mean, I can imagine if anybody was going to lay a complex plot like that, then Cecil's your man. He was certainly thought ahead, but there isn't any particular evidence about it. It's just, I mean, the surprising thing is that she could have died falling down a fairly short staircase. Sorry, I was going to say, it doesn't seem that he was generally accused of it until the 1580s.
Oh, okay. So what take me through the timeline then. So that was 1560. Yeah. And then what happened after
Well, what happened, definitely the relationship with Elizabeth became a little bit less blatant. By 1564, she was even suggesting that he should marry the Queen of Scots, an idea that Robert certainly didn't like at all, because although he wanted to marry a queen, he certainly didn't want to marry the Queen of Scots and go off to Scotland. He wanted to marry Elizabeth. Then after that, he still hoped that she would marry him. And it seems that every time that another suitor, because of course she had so many, both foreign and at home, came too close, he would muddy the waters, or she would almost use him as a way of wriggling out of a marriage with anybody else. And she'd flaunt a relationship with him, perhaps to discourage foreign princes who might think twice about a wife who had perhaps not the best reputation if she was spending so much time with another man. But he definitely spent quite a lot of time upsetting other marriage proposals, possibly on her orders. I mean, we don't know. So as soon as one match was put forward, so for example, the Archduke of Austria, Charles, he would then suggest that the King of Sweden was a much better match. Or if the King of Sweden looked like he was in front, then he would suggest one of the other archdukes, just to, you know, keep everything up in the air rather than Elizabeth making a decision. Round about the 1568, he embarked on an affair, possibly then, possibly not till a little later, with one of the Queen's relatives, actually, Douglas Howard, who was Lady Sheffield. And there are some stories that he had an affair with her whilst she was still married. It's the only letter that appears to be between the two suggests it wasn't till after she was widowed. I mean, there are so many rumours and scandals about him. It's very difficult to tell what happened when and how much has been suggested afterwards. Possibly married Douglas Sheffield in secret. She said during Elizabeth's lifetime that they hadn't married, but then after Elizabeth's death, she said that they had. He certainly he acknowledged their son, but he always said that they weren't married.
Then he had the great pageant where he tried to woo. I mean, would you say that he was trying to win her over?
I think it was probably the last ditch attempt. So it was 1575. She was 42 and he was either 42 or 43. His birth date isn't certain. And it was the greatest pageant of her reign. He spent apparently some £60,000 on it, which is, a sum we can't even imagine what it would be in modern money. She was with him for 18 days at Kenilworth Castle. And the whole thing was just an extraordinary series of events from the moment she arrived, when she was met by a sibyl, prophesying long life and good health. And then there was a pageant from the Lady of the Lake, and there's quite a lot of Arthurian symbolism. There were wild men who from the forest who appeared to be overcome by the beauty of this stranger, didn't know she was a queen, but recognized her as particularly beautiful. And then there were some local pageants that local people got involved with. There was Robin Hood and Maid Marian and the country wedding. There was singing, there was cornets, and there were oboes, and there was picnics and hunting and fireworks and every kind of display that you can imagine. But if she was tempted, she didn't give in.
No.
it's a bit sad in a way. It seems almost like a last ditch attempt, because, I think he probably thought by then it was never going to happen. It was almost like a sort of a final love gift, really. I do think he was genuinely attached to Elizabeth. I don't think it was all, I mean, I'm sure there was ambition in it, but I don't think it was all about ambition.
Mm-hmm. And the same for her with him, do you think?
Yes. Yeah. No, quite. And she was very open about her affection for him, although she would sometimes describe their affection as more of siblings than anything else. So I think it was a mixture of romantic and I suppose over the 30 years of her reign that he was alive during, you don't carry on at the white heat of romantic love, especially if nothing ever comes of it. So but they were almost like a pair of old married people by the end. She called him her eyes. She liked to give them nicknames. And she's distraught at his death.
Right. So take me through then. He realized they weren't going to get married. And so then he got married again.
He did. And... yes. Another of Elizabeth's cousins, which possibly, and she, the pictures of Lettice Knowles, who was the Dowager Countess of Essex, she does look like Elizabeth, which suggests, you know, that it was definitely a physical type that he was attracted to. And he and Lettice seem to have actually been very happily married. She had four children by her first marriage, of whom he became very fond, particularly her son, Robert, Earl of Essex, whom he promoted almost as though he were his own son. The daughter, Penelope, she became the ward of Robert's sister and brother-in-law. And the other children, you know, were also very close to him. So they seem to have been quite a close family. Elizabeth was beside herself with anger. She never forgave Lettice, who she called that she-wolf. It took her a while to forgive Robert. It was it was probably 2 or 3 years before he was really back in her good books. But then she just dealt with it by sort of ignoring Lettice's existence and keeping Robert at court as much as she could. But he seems to have been very fond of Lettice. I mean, there's no, you know, I'm not sure she was necessarily second best. They were happily married, and I mean, she outlived him by, you know, 45 years, I think, but she chose to be buried beside him, even though she'd remarried. Yes, Elizabeth was not happy about it.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I suppose she felt betrayed, you know, that he was the person who she was closest to, and now he'd gone and got himself a wife. Yeah.
Well, what did she expect he was going to do, you know?
Well, yes, and I think that's how he did think she was unreasonable, but and I think they all thought she was unreasonable. I mean, she wanted to send him to the Tower, but Cecil had to point out that really he hadn't actually committed any crime by marrying.
So then he was, towards the end of his life, was involved with the Spanish Armada, and that was when he died right after that as well, right? Can you tell me?
Well, throughout the 1570s, I mean, although he was... he was actually, well, like all Elizabethans, a very religious man. He was definitely on the more Puritan end of the scale amongst Elizabeth's ministers. So he would align with Walsingham, Francis Knowles, his father-in-law, and Cecil, who were more Protestant than, say, some of the Earl of Arundel, for example, who was a Catholic. So he was always very much in favour of England and Elizabeth supporting Protestants abroad, and that's the policy that he supported throughout the 1570s and the early 1580s. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Elizabeth was very, very reluctant to provoke Philip of Spain. Apart from anything else, she wasn't that, she didn't want to provoke him to the point of war, and also she wanted to keep the balance between France and Spain, which it was sort of the long-term Tudor policy. But yeah, so Robert was very much in favour of helping the Protestants in the Netherlands. And eventually Elizabeth was worn down, and she did commit money and men to it. As I say, he was chosen to lead the English troops in the Netherlands, but not with any great success. But the result of it, of course, was that Spain was provoked, and that, together with the execution of Mary Queen of Scots, brought about the Spanish Armada. I mean, obviously there's all sorts of complications, but that's the sort of basic idea. And Robert, he was chosen, despite not having been terribly successful in the Netherlands, he was appointed as Lieutenant General of the land forces, and he set up the camp at Tilbury and invited Elizabeth to come along and review the troops. Rather touchingly, people were worried about her safety, and he was certain that she was so loved that she would be quite safe in the camp, which turned out to be the case. And he was beside her when she made her famous speech about having the heart and stomach of a king. Yes. And then afterwards they dined together in his tent, but he was feeling quite poorly. I mean, it was within a few days that it became apparent that the Armada had been defeated by a combination of the weather and the navy. And so Robert asked permission to retire from court to go to Buxton. He liked to go to Buxton to take the spa waters there. He'd been there 2 or 3 times. And she gave him permission. So he and Lettice went off at the end of August 1588. But he didn't make it. He died, I think, on the 4th of September 1588. So it really took the shine off the defeat of the Armada for Elizabeth. She locked herself in her room for several days, and the story is that Sir Walter Raleigh actually had the door broken down, but don't know whether anybody would have dared to break the Queen's door down, but she kept his last letter that he'd written her en route to Buxton for the rest of her life, and it was found in a little box next to her bed when she died.
So why did you choose him as the person of the month?
Well, because he is an interesting and I think his reputation has always been very black, and in particular there was an absolutely dreadful, slanderous, libelous pamphlet published in 1584 called, well, it had a very, very long name, but it's usually known as Leicester's Commonwealth. In it, he's accused of absolutely everything. He didn't just murder Amy, he murdered Douglas, he murdered Lettice's husband, he murdered Douglas's husband, he polished off a French cardinal, he tried to murder Sir Nicholas Throckmorton. I mean, you know, this list of crimes is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. He molested all of Elizabeth's ladies, and, you know, so there's just this whole, you know, really horrible things were written about him, and the mud stuck. I mean, Elizabeth didn't believe any of it, and she took the step of having the work banned, and she didn't normally make specific statements about things, you know, because there was quite a bit of scurrilous propaganda about. But she was very angry about this particular one. And she, as part of the proclamation suppressing it, she pointed out that it was actually a veiled attack on her, and that there's no way that she would be so lacking in judgment as to have a scoundrel of that sort as her minister. But it certainly stuck. And that's, I think, a lot of the slanders in Leicester's Commonwealth have shaded his historical reputation. So I suppose we wanted to find out a bit more about him. Yeah, and he's interesting. And I think I don't know, it always seems a little bit sad somehow. You sort of get the impression that he just never quite, he didn't quite marry the Queen. He lost, he and Lettice had a little boy who died as a child, so he couldn't achieve his ambition of starting a new dynasty. He wasn't quite successful as in the Netherlands, so he just never quite made it somehow. But yeah.
And so where can people go to learn more about him?
Well, I can't find a good solid biography of him. There's The Death and the Virgin that I mentioned that's mainly about Amy Robsart, but Chris Skidmore, who's very good, goes into a whole lot of other stuff. There's quite a lot about him in the books about Elizabeth, of course, because it is unfair to think of him as just her lover. He was an important part of her government. So Anne Somerset's Elizabeth the First, that's a good source. There is actually his account books for a couple of years are available, which are interesting. There's a book by a chap called Derek Wilson called The Uncrowned Kings of England, The Black Legend of the Dudleys, which is talks about him and his father and his illegitimate son, or possibly not illegitimate son, his son by Douglas Sheffield. It's not sort of massively in depth, but it's an interesting introduction. So, no, it is actually, I think the world is due a biography of Robert Dudley, actually. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else we should know about him?
What else? He was actually also a great patron of literature. And I think when we were talking earlier, we were thinking about, did Shakespeare attend the revels at Kenilworth? And of course, as you rightly pointed out, it was not far from his home. And there were an awful lot of the local populace did go to see the Queen. And so he may have done. But yeah, Lord Leicester had his players. And right, he also, yeah, patronised quite a lot of literature and, yeah, literary works and translations and so forth. Yeah, so he was an intelligent man, well-read. He was great, a lot of interest in mathematics and scientific discoveries. He was also, like Elizabeth, he patronised John Dee, you know, the sort of alchemist stroke mathematician.
Sure.
Yeah, so he was a man, and because Elizabeth wouldn't have been interested in a stupid man. He was an intelligent, well-educated, cultured man, ambitious, possibly. He would have been an interesting man to have dinner with. Oh, yes, unless he was going to poison you, because apparently he poisoned Margaret Lennox as well.
Oh.
It's all very hard to believe.
He was really busy
wasn't he? Yes, yes, he had. Yeah. In Leicester's Commonwealth, it talks about the secret potion that he patronised Italian scholars. And of course, as soon as anybody said Italian, it was kind of synonymous with poisoner in those days.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about Robert Dudley. For more information on him, go to tutortimes.co.uk
or you can also see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. And remember, if you like this show, the biggest way that you can help it to succeed is to leave a review on iTunes. It's the best thing you can do. You can also tell a friend about the show. I would love to see this community grow and become even more vibrant. The Facebook groups are so active and it's so great to see. And it would be so awesome to see even more people come into our beautiful little community here. So the next time you're talking to your tutor friends, tell them to listen to the show, right? Because they like shows. They like tutors. Here's a show about the tutors. So I'm actually going to be taking a little break over Christmas, but don't worry, you're still going to hear my voice. It just won't be recorded right at the same time. Because what I'm going to do is actually pull the audio from some of the mini courses that I did this past year. Some of you might know I put together little online mini courses for this community from time to time. Last year I did a couple. One was on kick-ass tutor women. So I'm actually going to pull some of the audio from that and put that out on the feed so you can enjoy that even if you didn't get a chance to do the course live when we were doing it. So you'll still get to hear from me, but you won't hear from me live again until January. And at that point, I'm actually going to start doing a little bit of a look at the Tudor England relationship with the Ottoman Turks, and especially kind of culminating in the Battle of Lepanto. So that's what we're going to do. Every January, we kind of do foreign policy. Last year, it was France. The year before, it was Spain and the Armada. So this year, we're going to be looking a little bit further east to the Ottoman Turks and the relationship and what was going on with Europe, with that relationship, and England specifically, of course. So I wish you all so much joy and peace and love. However you celebrate this time of year, if you're out with the Druids doing solstice stuff, if you're doing Hanukkah, if you're doing Christmas, if you're doing any variation of anything, I hope it's so much fun. I hope it's so cozy. I hope it's so warm. And I hope you have so much love surrounding you and wrapping you all up. And I am so grateful to you for listening to me this past year, for listening to me, those of you who have been with us for a long time. We're going on 9 years here, guys. I started this podcast in 2009, and some of you have been with me since the very beginning, and I'm so grateful to you, and I'm so grateful to those of you who just found me for listening, and really, I just love you all so much. I just am so happy that I get to talk about Tudor England like this, and you let me. It's so amazing. So thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season. Thank you for letting me be part of your year this year. Thank you to those of you who bought the Tudor Planner for letting me be part of your planning next year and your diarizing next year. And thank you for your continued listenership and support and friendship. You guys are awesome. All right. Talk to you in January. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, a scentful may be sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hörte Bord in Bauerbrick, at Solis am Lison See.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.